Welcome back to the History of South Africa podcast with me, your host, Des Latham. Episode 190 is about the ocean and a staggering event. And by the way, if you can hear vague noises in the background, it's because we've been hit here on the coast by a powerful storm. Winds gusting 80 kilometers an hour, which is almost symbolic, I guess, given the context of what we're talking about today. The sinking of the HMS Birkenhead off Hans Bay, south of Cape Town, an event which led to the famous phrase, "women and children first," in maritime law. All, of course, also linked to the fierce 8th Frontier War of South Africa, because there were hundreds of troops on board the ship when it went down. It's believed 445 drowned or were eaten by sharks. The chronicle of what happened is riveting. The terrifying ordeal for the survivors of the ship became part of the mid-19th century Victorian consciousness. The sinking of the Birkenhead also remains one of the greatest maritime disasters off South Africa's coast. But the fact that every one of the women and children aboard survived the wreck, owing to the gallantry and discipline of the men on board, has been immortalized in maritime law. The soldiers of the British Army regiments and the sailors and marines under Captain Robert Salmond jeopardized their own chances of survival by putting the women and children first. This all stems from the ongoing 8th Frontier War we've been covering now for a couple of episodes. The British fighting the Amaxhosa were in need of reinforcements, particularly the 74th Highland Regiment, which had borne the brunt of fighting along the Amatola Ridges and the valleys, Waterkloof, Mount Misery, which had caused hundreds of casualties. In many ways, the Birkenhead was also a symbol of the age of innovation. She was one of the first iron-hulled ships ever built for the Royal Navy and was converted into a troop ship. As she was being laid down, the Navy switched its main propulsion to propeller from paddle wheels. So the paddle-wheeled HMS Birkenhead ended up being converted from frigate to troop carrier. The Birkenhead was also among the early attempts to marry sail and steam and rigged as a brigantine with two masts, a third being added later. She was powered by two 564 horsepower steam engines from Forrester and Co. that drove a pair of 6-meter-high paddle wheels. Birkenhead is on the west bank of the Mersey River opposite Liverpool. The Mersey Railway connected Birkenhead and Liverpool with the world's first tunnel underneath a tidal estuary. The HMS Birkenhead had its fair share of incidents before its final voyage in 1852. On the 15th of September 1847, for example, it ran down and sank the brig Horatio in the English Channel off Cornwall. The owners of the brig sued for their loss in the Admiralty Court and won. Her captain had posted no lookout, being short of crew. As part of her conversion to a troop ship in 1851, a forecastle and poop deck were added to increase accommodation. Then a third mast was added to change her sail plan to a barkentine. Although she never served as a warship, she was faster and more comfortable than any of the wooden sail-driven troop ships of the time, making her first trip to the Cape in 37 days in October 1850. However, it was a journey HMS Birkenhead would make for the last time in January 1852. Under command of Captain Robert Salmond, it steamed to Portsmouth in the first week of January to pick up troops from 10 different regiments, including the 2nd and 74th. On the 5th of January, she sailed across the Irish Sea to Queenstown and picked up officers, wives and children. All told, there were 479 soldiers on board and more than 50 women and children, as well as a crew of 125. That was a total of 693 stuffed into an iron hull, less than 64 metres long and just over 11 metres wide, about the width of a tennis court. Even though she was thought of as well-built, the early iron used in shipbuilding was quite brittle and tore easily compared to the iron of later ships. The weather off Ireland was dreadful when they set sail. A gale was blowing. The seas were high, but Captain Salmond decided to chance the storm because Cape Governor Sir Harry Smith and the British were in dire straits and needed reinforcements as quickly as possible. They just could not defeat Makoma and Sandile Kanika. Even though the captain was in a hurry, she couldn't defeat the weather, and Birkenhead took 47 days to reach Simon's Bay, 10 days slower than its record. Three women died during the crossing. Miraculously, four babies were born. the circle of life on board an iron-hulled machine of the Victorian era. Upon arrival at Simon's Bay, most of the civilians disembarked, leaving only 7 women and 13 children on board. Fuel, food, 9 horses and forage were loaded, along with more passengers. Then HMS Birkenhead set sail once more at 1800 hours on the 25th of February 1852, heading for Algoa Bay and then East London. Captain Salmon made a few hasty calculations and decided to sail close to the coast, heading southeast towards Cape Agulhas. Time was of the essence, but 2 factors transpired against the captain. One was the compasses were registering small errors, making navigation tricky, and the other was a strong southeast current was sweeping into Walker Bay and carrying the ship closer to shore than the crew realized. After their gale-strewn crossing from Ireland, the trip out of False Bay that night was clear, with no wind. Stars were brightly shimmering. HMS Birkenhead steamed along at 8.5 knots, about 2 nautical miles offshore, just under 4 kilometres. The swells were smooth, rolling her slightly side to side, steadily rocking the passengers in their sleep. At 2 in the morning they changed with a bang. The Birkenhead's lookouts hadn't seen a notorious group of rocks which were uncharted off a place called Danger Point. When the sea ran rough, these rocks sprayed water about, but in this oily swell, the rocks were almost invisible. The Birkenhead's hull was ripped open, drowning many of the men in their bunks in the forward cabins immediately. The survivors rushed to the deck along with Captain Salmon. The engines were still going at full power, so he shut them down. He summed up the situation quickly and ordered the boats launched. Only 3 of the 8 swung down. The other 5 boats had been damaged or were stuck. What we should remember is that there was no such thing as a boat drill, which all passengers receive these days in case of an emergency. As chaos began to develop with the soldiers running about yelling, Lieutenant Colonel Seaton stepped forward and would be immortalized. "Women and children first," he yelled, brandishing his sword and a pistol, and the soldiers stopped dead in their tracks, then formed up and stood at attention. In the calmness, the women and children clambered aboard the rowboats, which were cut loose. The horses were also pushed off deck. Some began swimming towards shore, some out to sea. It was silent on board the sinking ship as the rowboats creaked away, oars dipping in and out of the calm sea. Captain Salmon made the fateful decision at this moment to try and refloat HMS Birkenhead. It was so close to shore. This was an attempt at saving his men. As he put the engines in reverse, the boat shuddered backwards, was hit by a swell again, and plunged back onto the rocks. This time its forward section broke right off, and now HMS Birkenhead was in its death throes, grinding and groaning as she tore herself to bits. The soldiers continued to stand on parade on deck in exemplary fashion. Surviving officer Captain Edward Wright of the 91st Regiment wrote later that "Everyone did as he was directed, and there was not a murmur nor a cry among them until the vessel made her final plunge." The soldiers were herded to the stern as it began to sink rapidly from the bow. Then the ship slipped below the waves. Luckily for some, it was in relatively shallow ocean, so the masts and rigging remained above the water, and dozens of men clung on for their dear lives. Meanwhile, the women and children had been rowed halfway to the shore and were in no danger of being overcome, and then Seaton called out, "Every man for himself!" They all launched themselves into the Indian Ocean. Most of the sailors and soldiers couldn't swim. In fact, most sailors of this period thought being able to swim was actually bad luck. It also made some crazy sense because, logically, the thinking was that if any man fell overboard, they were basically dead anyway, as the ship was unlikely to be able to turn around and get him back before he drifted away. Rather drown immediately than string out your death throes. There was a lot of debris floating about, and soldiers and sailors clung onto the tables and wooden barrels, bundles of hay, spars, stools, chairs, and other flotsam, and then tried to paddle to shore. Only one man on board had a life jacket, privately owned by Cornet Bond of the 12th Lancers. He put on his life jacket and jumped into the sea, swimming to the beach near the modern-day town of Hans Bay. He dragged himself up to a sandy spot, spluttering and coughing. Couldn't believe his eyes. Standing above him, looking down, was his horse. It had also managed to swim to shore. 80 of the men were rescued by boats, while others continued clinging to the topmast. Many more were splashing about, flailing, trying to keep their heads above the water. In a cruel twist of fate, they were swimming in an area notorious for its white shark population. These sharks began to take the men. A famous story made the rounds later about a man called Alexander Russell of the 74th Highlanders, who gave up his place in one of these boats for a man who was drowning, only to be dragged under by a shark moments later. There was so much blood in the water from the injured men, it was a banquet for the creatures of the deep. Survivors were mostly those who jumped into the water fully clothed. It was the men who were naked or semi-naked who appeared to be targeted by the white sharks. Some of the men splashed to shore and then became ensnared in the kelp, which is thick on this coast, and then drowned in sight of the sand. The ship's little boat, a type called a gig, made for Hunklip and landed near a place called Fisherhaven. One of the fishermen living there lent a sailor his horse, and the sailor went on a wild ride for 60 kilometers back to Cape Town to break the news. This gig was left at Fisherhaven as security for the horse, and was still being rowed about in Fisherhaven in 1952, 100 years later. But the sun rose on the 26th of February 1852 to dreadful scenes as seriously injured men washed up on the beaches along with the corpses of the dead mutilated by the sharks. The dead were buried in shallow graves along the shore, and they remain buried there to this day. Others spent 38 hours in the water, but somehow survived both hypothermia and the sharks. Incredible tales of heroism were spun, and soon word reached the British about the shipwreck. If anything good can come from a disaster, the HMS Birkenhead did set off a series of developments when it came to maritime safety. The call "Women and Children First" is now common in all kinds of disasters around the world, and first heard here on the coast of South Africa. Emergency drills for passengers were introduced after this. Such was the importance that not only was it forever embedded in sailors' consciousnesses, the King of Prussia ordered the entire story of the Birkenhead read to every one of his regiments and soldiers, a kind of motivational lecture back in the day. The King was impressed by the fortitude of the regimental soldiers and officers. Queen Victoria ordered a memorial to be erected in the colonnade of the Chelsea Hospital when she heard of the disaster. So what became known as the Birkenhead drill was one of the most glaringly bright, self-glorifying legends of the 19th century for the British. But when it came to the war effort, the wreck was both a catastrophe and a disaster. Virtually the entire reinforcement component en route to the Eastern Cape had been wiped out. Harry Smith was in King Williamstown when he received what you could call a double whammy. First, the report regarding the loss of the Birkenhead and thus his reinforcements, and secondly, a letter of recall from Colonial Secretary Earl Grey, as one of my sons likes to say, slap slap. Smith, however, was determined to complete his final military operation before leaving, so he began a massed advance into the Waterkloof on the 10th of March, and by the 20th of March 1852, or just 10 days, he managed to succeed where others had failed over 14 months. It was also the first time in the entire 8th Frontier War that Smith himself had led soldiers into action. Why had he waited until he was notified of recall before he decided to personally lead columns into the mountains? Perhaps the decades of non-stop warfare had taken their toll on him, a form of post-traumatic stress disorder that led to poor decision-making. Some historians suggest he could have been suffering from an undisclosed illness. One thing everyone was sure about, it wasn't cowardice that kept him away. Up to now, Smith had left the 8th Frontier War to men who were ignorant of bush warfare, like Colonel Fordyce, or incompetence like Mackinnon and Somerset. Smith was aware of these shortcomings, but dogmatically continued to support his other staff. Just to give you an idea about the cynical attitude, after he was informed of Colonel Fordyce's death by a koi koi sniper you heard about last episode, he flipped off the news with a contemptuous... He showed himself with his telescope outside the bush and was picked off by some skillful Hottentot. He was pointing fingers at Somerset by now for his own failures, but his final days leading the charge into the Amatullahs were coldly calculating. Alongside him was the man I mentioned last episode too, Lieutenant Colonel Eyre. Ruthless would be an understatement. Eyre was unsentimental and gave no quarter, and believed in direct action. Men of his company regarded him as the only British officer who knew what he was doing in the bush. In that there was no debate. He was not your typical officer. His men had to wear their red uniforms, but he turned a blind eye to the use of rough patches and strange hats, unusual bags. He mixed the British way with the Boer and African way. He also read the landscape accurately, understanding his army's strengths and weaknesses. He operated at night, like Thomas Stubbs, the settler, had suggested. Eyre penetrated the Vitalcliff ravines while Smith waited below, and they systematically swept the mountains of all Amaxhosa. For Eyre, this meant taking no prisoners. He killed everyone he came across, men and women, although he did allow children to go free. He knew the Amaxhosa women were taking part in the war, and had been directly involved in executing British soldiers, mainly by torturing them to death. So by the time Eyre and his men began to exact revenge, the idea of clemency was a distant concept from a forgotten time. The Mamfengu mercenaries were willing participants in these executions. The torture of British captives by Xhosa women meant that the rank-and-file soldier turned their eyes from summary killings. They had seen the effect of men slowly tortured to death for days, and whatever sentiment they held about women and warfare before they arrived in South Africa were dealt a mortal blow. The so-called civilizing mission ethos had dissolved in the bush of the Eastern Cape. When wounded Xhosa warriors were discovered by the British, they handed most to the Amamfengu, who killed most of these gratuitously. Then the bodies were looted. Karosses, beads, tortoise shell snuff boxes, ivory rings, necklaces grabbed from the dead by both Amamfengu and British soldier. Yes, folks, there's no grand moment in warfare despite the propaganda. I will avoid the most startling descriptions of some of the acts on both sides for the sake of good taste, but would say you should use your imagination to dream up the worst things that humans can do to each other. This is what characterized the final weeks of the grinding Eighth Frontier War. In 10 days of extreme action, Harry Smith and Lieutenant Colonel Eyre accomplished their tactical aim. Makoma and his sons were driven off the mountains, along with the Khoi Khoi rebels, and resistance collapsed along the Fish River and the Amatollahs generally. Lieutenant Colonel Eyre located Makoma's main HQ, a massive cave, where 130 women were hiding. The men had fled. These women were not killed because Makoma's Khoi wife Kati was amongst them. When she was brought before Harry Smith, Eyre waved Makoma's karos in front of Kati and asked if it was her husband's. She glared at him and said sarcastically, "Did you discover him in it?" Finally, the Vitalcliff was clear, and with great fanfare, Harry Smith marched his way back to King Williamstown. His success story swan song, or so he thought. You have to pinch yourself when I tell you what happened next. He had barely sat down for his first post-Vitalcliff banquet when a messenger arrived informing him that Makoma was back in his great cave. So were his warriors. Had he had a social media account, Smith would have typed WTF, shocked face emoji. Smith first rubbished the report until he spoke to former missionary Charles Brownlee. "It was true," said Brownlee. "You see, Makoma had heard that Smith had been fired, stroke recalled, and thought if he was still in the Vitalcliff when the successor arrived, Damakosa could negotiate better terms. Makoma also knew about the Birkenhead disaster and realized that Smith's reinforcements were drowned. As I've reminded everyone, news could travel far quicker than we imagined back in those days. For example, Damakosa's use of fires on hilltops meant that signals could transfer from East London all the way to Alice in less than 15 minutes. Only at night, mind you, but still incredible, isn't it? To give you an idea how fast that is, in 2009, a test of internet speed showed that a pigeon called Winston took 1 hour and 8 minutes to fly 100 kilometers from Pietermaritzburg to Durban with a data card strapped to its foot. In the same time, only 4% of the data was downloaded via a telecom internet connection. Admittedly, the Amaxhosa messaging system came with preambles. The signal fires could only really be useful after dark, and they were pretty much binary. In other words, the They serve to confirm an earlier message, on off, reinforcements on the way, or Smith has arrived, or Smith's successor has arrived, that kind of thing. So news of Smith's firing reached Makoma very quickly, and the aging Amakosa chief was delighted. His old adversary finally had received the boot, and he was free, a thorn in the British Empire's side. Speaking of fires and signals, when Smith's successor Sir George Cathcart stepped off his coastal steamer in East London on the night of the 8th of April 1852, literally the moment his boots hit the land, great fires began to blaze along the ridges, fire after fire, receding into the distance. British officers said later that Cathcart's arrival was known by everyone in British Kaffraria and the Transkei within a quarter of an hour. Faster than Winston the Pigeon and Telkom Internet circa 2009. Because, of course, both the Internet and red glare of Amakosa fires travel at the speed of light. With that, it's time to end this episode. Next, we'll return to the Boers, who had been following the goings-on down south with a great deal of interest. It was a perfect time to remind the British that they were an independent people, and apparently the political class in London was now prepared to listen. Please rate the podcast on your favourite platform. It helps elevate the visibility, and you can head off to desmondlatham.blog, where I'm going to load an update about this episode. You can email me from there too, and register for my newsletter. Until next, goodbye.